Today I'll spend just one lecture on what's known as the theory of Landau's Fermi liquid. It's a pretty big subject, so with one lecture I'll be only scratching the surface of it, just tell you some very basic concepts. But if you want to learn more, here are some references. So this is a book by Anderson. I mean, doesn't really teach you how to calculate anything, but it teaches you how to think. So if you want to get more insights, I encourage you to read. Also, there's a classic book known as AGD in the field. Typical Russian style, lots of Feynman diagrams, but lots of details here. I think these are in the 90s, people realized how to make sense of all this in the modern field theory and renormalization group framework. And these are two extremely pedagogical review articles on that subject. Okay, so starting from today, we'll move away gradually from the free fermion paradigm, which we spent quite a bit of time on. And before that, let me start with some general comments on effective interaction. Right. So microscopically, I mean, interaction can take complicated forms. For example, the simplest ones, you can write them as something like U, Ci dagger, Ci, Cj dagger, Cj. It's like a density-density coupling. Let's say I and J are some sites on my lattice. For example, suppose I want some local interaction, which means I and J are pretty close together. So this is a schematic form. For example, the nearest neighbor or something like that. And there are many different possibilities. So in general, this could look very complicated. And the thing with interaction is it can no longer be diagonized by just doing a simple Fourier transform. For quadratic theory, as long as I have translation symmetry, I just go to the momentum space, and then the Hamiltonian looks diagonal. I just then solve some simple matrix with dimension depending on the number of orbits in the unit cell. But with interaction, you can no longer do that. If you try to Fourier transform this, it's still a mess. If you try to Fourier transform this, for example, you get something like, depending on the detail of the form, typically you can get something like uq c dagger k plus k prime plus q c dagger k minus q c k prime c k, something like that. You just literally Fourier transform all these four operators. You see something of this sort. In the integration, let me be a little bit more explicit. The integration goes all the Qs, all the Ks, and all the K prime. Essentially, every Fourier transform in this operator gets you a momentum, and total momentum conservation means that three of the four momentums are linearly independent. And then in the integration, you still have three momentum to integrate. Unlike for quadratic Hamiltonian, where you get two momentum, and by momentum conservation, they are opposite, so you end up with only one momentum. Right? That's how you can diagonize the Hamiltonian in momentum space. But now, with interaction, even if you have translation symmetry, you still get this mess. So in general, if it looks complicated, it is. Right? In general, it's hard to say exactly what it does. Right? So if this U happens to be very small compared to your characteristic scale, then you can try to do some provision theory and so on. But usually life is more complicated than that. Typically, this U may not be that small. For example, in the typical solid, in the metal, or in things like liquid helium and so on. So what do we do? Okay. So let's go back to the technique of adiabatic evolution, right? So imagine we turn on this U slowly. Well, you are slow compared to what? Well, we'll get to that. Okay. So now there are three scenarios. Remember, as I told you, phases of matter at low energy can be roughly categorized into three kinds. The first one is if I have a gap. If I have a gap state, which is known as an insulator, then life is simpler. So as long as I turn up my system on slowly enough, I can imagine evolving the ground state adiabatically. Okay. So as long as the gap remains non-zero throughout the process. So by the way, the process means that it's a time-dependent U such that at time equal to zero, U is zero, but at time equal to some final time, capital T, this is my final U. Okay? So that's what I mean by adiabatic turning on. And T can be pretty large. Okay? So as long as this is true, that the gap remains open throughout, then this process is adiabatic. So it's literally the same argument about insulator I made a couple of days ago, except now it's with interaction, not with some simpler provision. But the logic remains. Okay. So as long as this gap is open, the two states are similar. So this condition will always be true if the perturbation is much smaller than the gap, right? Because this gap can at most change by order U in that case. But if it's not true, then it may or may not be true. May not be true if U is comparable or even larger than delta, right? So that depends on the detailed situation. But it's conceivable that in many occasions, even if U is much larger than delta, in which case perturbation theory doesn't make sense anymore, right? You can't use perturbation theory. But this evolution can still remain adiabatic because the gap never closes. The gap evolves in some funny way and so on, but never closes. And then in that case, you can still say that the two phases are adiabatically connected. Very simple. Okay, so that's for gap states, which is relatively simple. For example, the chain insulator or integer quantum Hall state I told you about earlier this week, they are stable under electron-electron interaction, as long as the gap doesn't close under such an evolution. Okay? So you can still talk about Hall conductance and so on, even though your band theory may break down. You can't calculate the Chern number simply just from the band structure. But the Hall conductance will still remain quantized in the integer. Okay? So that's for gap state. Now let me comment briefly on what happens with the semi-metal, which so things like Dirac fermion in graphene. So this, I won't tell you how to reach the conclusion, but if you go through your field theory or renormalization group class, renormal initialization. That tells you that if I have interaction that's smaller than, for example, the bandwidth, then it won't change the qualitative behavior of the for example, the free Dirac fermion. Change quality. If my spatial dimension is larger than one, for example, the graphene will be d equal to 2, right? So we can talk about d equal to 3 and so on. So as long as I'm above one dimension, then small weak interaction doesn't change behavior of Dirac fermion. So I won't tell you why. Just for that, you do RG. So now we move to the third part, which is the main part of the story today, which is metals. Okay. Yes.
Can I just ask maybe a stupid question?
Yeah.
What's the W?
Sorry, the bandwidth.
Oh, okay.
For example, if I get a Dirac fermion beyond graphene, so this is my W. Yeah. Because in field theory language, this is your natural UV cutoff. So. All right, so metals. So for simplicity, let's forget about lattice. Just think about the simplest Fermi ball or Fermi sphere in free space, right? But now add interaction. It turns out even on the lattice, the story will be very similar. So let's not worry about lattice for now. So this is my field Fermi C. And let's even work at very close to zero temperature. So you can really think of this as a field Fermi C. If I try to now work with some adiabatic evolution type of argument, immediately you can object by saying that this is so horribly gapless, right? Every state has a zillion of states at the same energy, essentially. Right? If I make an excitation here, I can also make a tiny excitation by moving a particle from here, by removing a particle here and move it outside a little bit. That costs me a tiny little bit of energy. I can do it here. I can do it here. So this has tons of low energy, like infinitesimal energy excitations. And that's why the density of state is large. It's a constant as you go to zero energy. So it sounds like this, if you try to turn on interaction, doesn't matter how slow you get, this will be badly non-adiabatic. Because of the large density of state, essentially. As energy, or C goes to zero. Right? And that's why typically in the adiabatic argument, you require a gap. This one has no gap, yes.
Sorry, I don't see the relationship between an adiabatic process and the density.
Yeah, so remember, what is the condition for you to apply the adiabatic principle?
Slow
compared to what, right? Slow compared to the energy gap between the state you're interested in and any other state. That number is horribly zero here. Right, because you have too many states very close to zero energy. Yeah. For an insulator, that's not an issue. There is a natural gap. Right? So as long as you evolve slowly, slower than that, you're fine. This one, the gap, that number is zero. So you can't be smaller than that. Okay. And it's in some sense horribly zero, because they are, at any energy, there are effectively infinitely many states at that energy interval that can mix with the state you are interested in. So, yes?
So in a pure perspective, would this be like infrared divergence or something, like in the sense of like some low, many low energy excitations?
Not really. Well, not really, not really. Yeah. Well, this thing is a little bit weird from the QFT point of view. So if you want to view it from the field theory point of view, you have to make some adjustment. But yeah. Okay. So well, if that's the end of the story, I shouldn't be spending a lecture on that today. So it turns out that's a bit too quick, that statement. The thing is, it is true that if I doesn't matter how slowly I turn on my interaction, the adiabaticity won't hold. Because what happens is that now imagine I have a low energy excitation before I turn on the interaction. For example, imagine I have a field Fermi C plus a single particle out of the Fermi C. So imagine my state at time equal to zero is the Fermi C let me draw it this way. It's C K dagger times the field Fermi C. This just means this picture. Okay? With K slightly larger than KF. Right? Okay, just larger by a little bit. So that the energy of this particle is KF over M times K minus KF. And because it's only slightly, well, I'm keeping things to only leading order in K minus KF, there is a quadratic order term that I'm throwing away. And I'm assuming this is much smaller than my Fermi energy, which, let me remind you, is defined as KF squared over 2m. So imagine I start from a free particle eigenstate of this form, right? So it's a low energy excitation. And now let me ask, if I have an interaction now, so this term will mix with other term of the same energy, but how long does it take for that to happen? So if I now have interaction term of the form, essentially of this form, so that state won't be my eigenstate anymore, the Hamiltonian. So it will decay into some other stuff. But how long does it take? Yes?
So is that supposed to be a delta xi k? Like,
sorry, what?
Sorry.
Yeah, delta k minus kf is, delta k.
But the left-hand side of that equation, should it be a delta xi?
This one?
Uh-huh.
Why?
So it's just energy above it.
Yeah, it's just energy of this k state.
Okay.
Sorry, if you like, it's the energy minus mu. I'm measuring energy from time dimension. So how long does it take? Well, you see that what could it scatter, what could it decay to? Well, the thing is the interaction still preserves momentum and conserves charge. So you can't just create a particle out of nothing. So what will happen is this kind of process. So you scatter this particle from K to K, let me see, minus Q. Q is this momentum change. Well, that means you have to scatter another particle within the Fermi ball, which is previously occupied, K prime, let me call it, to K prime plus Q, just to conserve momentum. So this is the kind of scattering process at low energy that kind of term will introduce you. Okay? So to leading order, in perturbation theory, this is the process that destabilizes that state. And the time it takes, or the inverse time of that time, you can calculate within perturbation theory via Fermi's golden rule. So this is essentially time-dependent perturbation theory to second order. So if you haven't seen it, just don't worry too much, because the intuition is reasonably clear. So let me first write out the formula sorry, little d means the space dimension. Okay. So this camp is quite generally applicable to 2D, 3D, if you like, 4D. U Q square. And now there's a delta function, CK plus CK prime minus CK minus Q minus CK plus Q. So I'll write out the each term and then explain to you what they mean. Right, so don't worry if they look complicated now. Okay. So first of all, this is coming from second order perturbation theory. So essentially, this the lifetime is measured by a second order process, which you do this kind of scattering and then you go back. Okay. So that essentially measures your lifetime. So that's why you get this absolute value square here. And this delta function is just energy conservation, right? So my original energy is k and k prime. So I k here, k prime here. After that scattering process, my energy is k minus q and k prime plus q. So I want the two energy to agree so that this scattering can happen. Yes?
Was that a second order? I didn't get that part.
This is u square. I mean, just acting, you know, for example, acting on this state with u once, you can get something like this. So do it twice, you can get back. I mean, you calculate the lifetime through that. Yes?
Is this the time it takes for this process to happen?
Basically, yeah. So that's energy conservation. And now what about this factor? So this F is the Fermi distribution, which at low enough energy, you more or less take it to be a step function, which is this. Okay. So what's this telling you? Well, this is just, you know, literally telling you this picture. Because if I want this scattering process to happen, well, this k prime better be occupied before I start to scatter. Right, which means I better, because this number is either 0 or 1, right? So I better want this number to be 1. Okay. And likewise, since I want to scatter to some previously unoccupied state, these are fermions, so I want both k minus q and k prime plus q to be previously unoccupied, which means I better want the f to be 0 so that this number gives me 1. Okay. So each term actually makes sense. Right. The actual derivation, okay, you need to go through some algebra, but at the end of the day, just second order perturbation theory. Yes?
Just wondering, what would happen if you started with the ground state, like without that excitation to the bridge?
Yes, it will also, you know, the ground state, you can also take a particle from here to here, but turns out it will be less important for our concern, which I will explain later.
Isn't that because we want some kind of a gap to be there in order to do the adiabatic evolution?
Not really. There won't be any gap at the end of the day, but I'll explain. Okay, so it's an integral. You can do it. So what do you expect to get? In fact, I won't actually do the integral for you, and you don't have to do it because. What we need really is the overall structure. Can you see that? Okay. What is the structure? Well, so the important thing is how many k prime and q's. Remember, the two integrals are k prime and q. Actually, contribute. Turns out not that many, because for one thing, we know that CK is larger than zero, but small, right? Because I have a particle excitation out of the Fermi ball. And CK prime is negative, right? Because originally it's within the Fermi ball, it's an occupied state. But both CK minus K, sorry, and K prime plus Q, K minus Q and K prime plus Q, which are these two final states, they should have positive energy. So within that delta function, I have one positive number, CK, essentially minus three positive number. So all those three positive numbers should be less than that CK, essentially. Right? So CK prime smaller than zero, CK minus Q, and CK prime plus Q. Actually, let me write it this way. This minus C, K prime, they should all be greater than zero. So what does that mean? That means for that delta function to give you non-zero, what you need is this. So all three number should be smaller than CK. Okay. Simple arithmetic. But that means something profound. That means that for one thing, the K prime, which is this occupied state initially, can't be too deep within the Fermi C. Okay. So that means this KF minus K prime has to be smaller than the absolute value of K minus KF. Also, by the same token, the K plus Q state, the K minus Q state can't be too far away from the Fermi C. Right? Minus KF has to be also smaller than K minus KF. And remember, K minus KF is already a small number to begin with. Okay. Which means, even though I'm integrating K prime and Q in the entire momentum space, only a tiny fraction of those actually give me non-zero contribution in the integral. So roughly how much contribution do I get? Or if I do consider some radial integration, the range is given by this, essentially. Okay. Which means you expect the final number to be proportional to this K minus KF square. Essentially, the integration of K prime, for example, the radial integration, gives you a factor of K minus KF, because that's the range that gives you non-zero contribution. And the integration in Q also likewise gives you another factor of K minus KF square, K minus KF. So at the end of the day, you get K minus KF square. So let me be a little bit more precise, just a little bit actually. So 1 over tau, let me say a k, okay, because that's the k labels my excited state. I expect that to be some number, some positive number, times u square. So u really means the characteristic strength of that uq. Right? So uq can have some funny dependence on q. But there will be some characteristic scale strength. Okay. So then remember this K minus KF is also proportional to CK. Right. So this will be proportional to U square times CK square. Oh, you say that dimension doesn't match up, right? So this is 1 over time, so that should be an energy. This is energy square. This is energy square. So I need some energy cube in the denominator to fix the dimension. Well, what is the energy scale I still have? Now, remember, I've used up my u and ck. So what's the other energy scale I still have in my problem? The Fermi energy. So without doing any calculation, you know that it should look like this, just by dimension counting. Okay? And of course, this number is detail dependent. This depends on details like, you know, form of the actual interaction potential or shape of the Fermi surface. For example, here I've used the simplest shape of Fermi surface, a circle. But if I'm on a, you know, crystalline lattice, my Fermi surface won't be completely circular. So after you do the integration, you get a different number. Right? Shape of Fermi surface or even dimensionality. Right? So all those messy details come into this number. But the dependence on this energy scales is fixed.
Sorry. So
yes.
For the inequalities for the Cs, we start with CKs greater than zero.
Yes.
And then out of that, we get the other inequalities because of the relation between K and Q and K prime.
Well, the thing is, we know this.
Yeah.
We know all this. We know this.
Okay.
So this comes from the fact that I want K prime to come from within the Fermi C.
Okay, yeah.
And this two to be out of the Fermi C. So this would be true. But then that delta function means that these three positive numbers should add up to this positive number.
Right.
Which means they should individually be smaller than CK.
Right.
Then this follows.
Cool.
So we call this a phase-based constraint.
Okay.
The important thing is you get this factor. Why is that important? Actually, before I do that, let me just say that, okay, you can object by saying, okay, this is just second order perturbation theory. Right? That sounds pretty lame. So let's go to higher order and do perturbation theory. So I won't show you the detail, but you can imagine that if you go to higher order, this constraints from phase space will just penalize you even further. So you get even more factors of CK. Which means if, as long as CK is small enough, this is always true. Okay. And the funny thing is, even though I'm doing perturbation theory originally in U, the fact that this 1 over tau is small, for example, compared to the excitation energy, is not actually necessarily controlled by U. For example, U may be, I don't know, 0.5 EF, which is already huge. But this number can still be small. Okay. Of course, if U is too large, let's say 10 times EF, then you have problem. But as long as U is reasonably. Actually, no, let me keep this. Let me write on the other side. So what does this buy us, really? So what does this buy us? This means that now we can use a modified version of adiabatic argument. We see that it is true that eventually that state won't stay there forever. It will, go away. But as long as my energy is low, it takes very, really long for it to go away. Which means now I can imagine turning on this interaction, ut. Let me remind you, it means u at 0 is 0, u at final t is my u, at a rate such that this 1 over tau k is much smaller than 1 over t, but this number is much smaller than ck. What does that mean? That means that I'm turning on my interaction slowly enough so that CK still remains CK. Doesn't change that. So it'll almost look adiabatic. But not too slow so that I've turned on the interaction before my particle actually decayed away. And that's good enough, turns out. Right. So let me say that again. It's not strictly adiabatic. You can't be too slow. If you are slower than that decay rate, you're no good. Right. But you can be faster than the decay rate, but still much smaller than the excitation energy. Right? So from the particle point of view, you are pretty adiabatic. Okay? And this is made possible because that this 1 over tau at low enough energy, right, is much smaller than the energy itself. Okay? Or another way to say it is that you view 1 over tau is as the uncertainty in the energy of k, which if you want this thing to make sense, the uncertainty better be smaller than the actual energy itself. And that's true here. Again, at low enough energy. All right, so suppose I do this, quasi-adiabatic evolution. Let me be a little bit more clear what that really means. So suppose I start originally from a state like this, right? This is my t equal to 0 state. Now I turn on this u in this fashion with t satisfying this rule. So what does it become? Well, the thing, what it will become is something like you'll become the original state, probably superposed with other stuff, right? For example, what can happen is now it's this original state, but then together with some particle hole pairs excited, or not excited, like created, maybe plus some number times, you know, many particle, you know, still this particle k here. So like this, right? Essentially, there are many infinite such terms I can write, right? In general, you expect them to all appear. But the original state will remain with some weight, z. So it's a horribly infinite sum. And if this u is not too small, well, we don't want u to be too large, but if this u is like 0.1 EF or something, this could be a huge mess. Right? You can imagine there are infinitely many terms here. But as long as this particle is still there, I can say that this messy state is the adiabatic evolution of this simple state. And this picture only fails after a very long time. After the tau k, which is proportional to 1 over c square. Yes?
Can you explain that part again, that how this one particle and these sums with more than one particle?
No, this is not, the total particle number is conserved, right? I create some hole here, particle here, hole here, particle here.
Oh. And the position in the momentum space doesn't matter, or like, are they have to be sufficiently close to the Fermi surface, or they can be anywhere?
In principle, they can be anywhere. Yes. Yes. In principle, you could even have horrible things like you create a particle here, you create an excitation here, and you create a hole here, create a particle here, create a hole here, you create a particle here. In principle, it's not forbidden. Anything really. Because I've only demanded this u to be turned on sufficiently slowly. I didn't say that u has to be small or anything. So as long as this z is non-zero, or if this z is zero, it means this particle more or less has decayed away. So it's more like entering this failure regime. But as long as this z is non-zero, I can, you know, this identification is, there's no ambiguity. And in practice, sometimes, in real Fermi liquid, this z can be pretty small, like 0.1 or even less.
Sorry.
Yes.
What was the z?
This z is the coefficient of this, right? Because it becomes a superposition. So the amplitude of this original term is z.
So what's the problem if it does become zero? We still have superposition of states.
Yeah, you can't recover things essentially. If this is zero, let me ask you, if I hand you this configuration, I ask you which free particle state it came from. there's no way you can unambiguously define them. Right? I can say they come from this, but why can't I say come from this? Right? So, yes.
Okay.
So that Z is, so this gigantic messy object has a name. It's so this object is known as a quasi-particle. So obviously it's not a particle. It's not a single particle. It's not the original particle because it's a messy superposition. But I can label it as the adiabatic counterpart of some very simple state. Yes?
Can you just say again what the plus sigma is?
Oh, sorry. Plus is sum of many other things. Right? Could be very complicated. There are infinitely many of them.
Okay.
So this means that now if I have some excited state, so this is one particle state. Now it's straightforward to generalize that. If I have some low energy excited state, sufficiently low energy, then I can label a generic excited state. Now labeled by some fairly simple thing. For example, I can start from a free fermion ground state and say I put a particle here, put a particle here, put a particle here, or put a hole here. That's still some fairly simple state. So as long as this particle and hole have very low energy, meaning they are very close to the, sufficiently close to the Fermi surface, I can say that, you know, they evolve under this adiabatic turning on to some messy stuff, which I call a collection of quasi-particles or quasi-holes, if I have holes here. Right? The resulting state may be a mess, but it's adiabatically connected before this very long time scale, which creates a small uncertainty in my energy. Yes?
You said that there's some ambiguity in the holes and the particles that they're in the higher excited state, in the higher states, basically.
What do you mean by higher states?
Like these more complicated ones, more holes and more particles. I was just wondering if we consider spins of the fermions, is that ambiguity lost? Because
what do you mean? No, it doesn't. It's,
no?
Well, the thing is, it's an infinite sum plus one term. This has a finite amplitude, right? All those terms generically have some infinitesimal amplitude, if you normalize the state properly. All right, so another thing is, how do you think about this in real space? Right, this is, yes.
So our excited states, you said they were adiabatically connected, but we're also kind of not fully in the adiabatic limit?
Yeah, so the thing is, you turn on this adiabatic evolution, but you don't wait to too long time.
Okay.
It's like the saying that in the long run, we're all dead.
Okay.
So if it's long enough, we don't worry too much. Practically, that means that these states are not going to be the exact eigenstates of your Hamiltonian, right? But that's, it's almost like an eigenstate, except it comes with some energy uncertainty. But as long as this uncertainty is much smaller than the energy itself, we're okay with that.
So it's that borrowed energy that's usually...
Sorry?
It's the same notion of the borrowed energy because of the length scale... Because of the time scale that it's happening, is that concept or is it something else?
Sorry, say the word you mentioned again.
Borrowed energy.
Oh, borrowed energy. I'm not sure if it's the same thing actually. I'm not sure.
This condition is telling us that the rate that we turn on our thing has to be fast enough.
Fast enough so that you don't decay. You don't have the time to decay. But slow enough that this particle state can still oscillate, many times, right? Because if you like, this number tells you in time you oscillate like this, right? So if you turn on it too fast, for example, you're in the opposite region, then your particle changes before it even has any chance to oscillate in time. Then what do you mean by that particle, right? But in this region, the particle can still oscillate in time quite many times, right? So it still looks like a wave and stuff like that, right? Right. So this, the existence of this large intermediate regime is important for this argument.
So in experiments, can you actually tune that U?
No. So this is a Gedanken experiment. I mean, in experiment, well, at least not in solids, right? You don't actually tune. You're given the U,
right?
Right. But this thought process allows you to label this mess, which is not your exact eigenstate, but you know, reasonably close. In this sense, now you can relate that to some pretty simple free Fermion state. Yes.
So the idea here is more that we're going from this mess and we're saying we can go. And
yes.
Okay.
Yes. So the real power here is you can label this mess by something simple. This, you know, the sheer fact that you can label a complicated thing by some simple object can buy you a lot. That's what Bloch theorem told you, right? You have some complicated lattice, the electron moving in some complicated way, but then Bloch theorem tells you as long as you have that crystal translation symmetry, you can label states by some number called k, right? And then you have the notion of Brillouin zone, there are discrete number of bands, they come with some dispersion and Bloch wave function. The actual form of the dispersion and the Bloch wave function may depend on detail, but the existence of k and Brillouin zone already told you a lot. It's somewhat similar here. Yes?
I just don't know, what if we turn on this interaction too fast? What would happen if we do that?
Oh, this state decays very quickly away.
Why if we turn on the interaction fast, it decays?
Yeah. Essentially, this is the excitation energy.
Uh-huh.
So if you're that's the regime where you can still use some adiabatic argument, right? So the reason we need this is because eventually it's not adiabatic because there are too many other states, but I'm saying before this scale, you still want some notion of adiabaticity. So, or in another word, if this is turned on too quickly, this state will start to mix with states. Essentially, the transition rate from the adiabatic turning on will actually dominate over this rate from scattering. You don't want that to happen. Yes.
Right. Like in quantum field theory, when we talk about scattering experiments, you want to turn on an interaction.
Yeah.
But you treat it as if there is a scattering matrix where
sometimes it's very similar thought process. Yes.
Isolated.
Yes, yes. It's very similar thought process. Yes. Yeah.
So I'm a little bit confused about, so we are not considering the dynamics in momentum space at all. I mean, this is all.
Oh, these are labeled by momentum, right? I am assuming momentum conservation.
Okay, so what would this mean in the real space? I mean, this state would.
Yes. So that's what I'm going to say next. So what does this mean in momentum? In real space. In real space, the picture is actually not too complicated. Well, it is complicated, but it's not too complicated to draw, actually. So, real space. Essentially, we can still consider wave packets. Right. So, for example, we can start from the free fermion state and consider a wave packet, right, something like this, that moves in with momentum k. So, what that mess is giving you is that now this wave packet is dressed with a cloud of particles and holes, essentially. Yeah. So this is a particle hole cloud. If you like, think about each of those messy particle and hole you created as some additional wave packets. But because they come with, each term comes with a small amplitude. So you only essentially get a cloud around it. So it's like a dressed, sometimes it's called a dressed particle. It is like you actually move in a crowd, and you don't move on your own. You move by dressed with other people moving together with you, something like that. All right. So So yes.
So this is not the dispersion relation anymore.
No. This is a wave packet, right? So this is, I'm drawing in real space. So this is placed, the particle that's actually moving. So the statement is, for free particle, that you can basically think of this as particle moving. Now in this case, it's particle moving, but now it dresses it with a cloud that moves with it.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, if you want to write that as a mathematical expression, it could look very complicated, like something like that. But at least it's easy to draw. So, all right, let's have a 5-minute break, and then we'll resume.
Kind of reminds me of the Chellin-Lehmann spectral representation.
Oh, yes.
One particle,
yes.
Many particles.
Yes, yes, oh, yes, yes. They can all be, this all can be casted into those languages.
But what is exactly, what does this condition mean?
What condition?
This one that's like.
Yeah, that condition means your line is not a delta function line. It now has a spread with that delta k, delta c.
So from
right, so your spectrum line is not now infinitesimally sharp, but it gets sharper and sharper if you go to lower and lower energies. That's the statement. So instead of, let's say this is your chemical potential. So now instead of something like this, it becomes something like this. But this width gets narrower and narrower if you move the peak closer and closer to the chemical potential. Yeah.
Yes. So at like higher energies, you have more of a mess.
Yeah, if it's higher energy, it's a mess.
I also
yeah. Right, but low energy, there is a universal pattern. That's the same.
Yeah, so I guess not.
Why do you call that a
quasi-particle? Yeah, it's going about 4th percentile.
That's just a name. You want to call it a particle, but we know it's not really just a particle.
Right.
Right, so. But for many purposes, you can treat it like a particle. Sorry?
Make this a little bit more precise. What would the vertical axis in this plot?
Oh, your spectral weight.
I mean,
can I think of this from geometry?
Yeah. It is a geometric constraint, right? You ask how many k prime and q's can satisfy this rule.
It's like a shell.
Yes.
But,
so the thing is, both k prime and q, or if you like k minus q, only live on in a very thin shell.
Yeah.
So each shell comes with a factor of k minus kf.
I'm not totally sold on this argument that like you come up with a like.
Yeah, this is. I mean, you can actually do a real calculation and see something like that. But on dimensional ground, that has to be the case, right? What else can you have? There's no other energy scale you can use.
I also have like a weird question. So this idea of creating a hole in a particle.
Yeah.
Can you create a big enough hole to create an analyst of sorts? I mean, there can be multiple holes in proximity. Or is there a limit to the way you create holes?
Yeah, deep in the Fermi C, crazy things can happen. You don't count.
So there can be one crazy state in which there's like an analyst.
Yeah,
there's a ring here.
Yeah, it probably has a vanishing amplitude, but yeah. in principle, nothing forbids you from doing that.
In real space, that would be ordering of charges. I mean, like,
not necessarily, not necessarily.
I'm trying to think that, like, when you are saying this, I mean, like, you would cover this, but I'm saying that if I have to pin down or if I have to understand the geometric property of this cloud.
Yes.
So we call it a cloud to give it
yeah.
uncertainty and we
yes.
have perturbations. But let's say if I'm giving it a certain formulation.
Okay.
Then the corresponding momentum space picture will like have certain features or
Not really. I mean that is a superposition really of all kinds of particles and clouds, right? It's not a definitive state. And in fact it's an infinite superposition. So yeah. So directly thinking about that is in general pretty complicated. Unless the interaction is weak, then you use perturbation theory. But otherwise, it's actually non-trivial. All right, so I said you can label your excited states as essentially some quasi-particle states, right? Precisely defined as the adiabatic evolution or quasi-adiabatic evolution of some free particle state. So what this buys you is that at the end of the day, essentially you treat them as almost free particles, okay? Even though the actual system may be pretty horribly interacting. Okay? But doesn't mean everything is unchanged. Lots of things can change. For example, the energy itself doesn't have to stay invariant under adiabatic evolution. As we know that, you know, if I have two energy levels under adiabatic evolution, the energy itself can change quite a bit, right? So this energy, remember, is defined as kf over m times k minus kf. So we still expect the ordering of the energies to be roughly the same. So we don't expect this functional form, the dependence on k, to change much. But this number in front, the coefficient or the velocity that determines the energy of an excited state doesn't have to stay invariant. There's no reason that it will. So in general, in the energy or the mass, which is defined this way, can change. This is known as the effective mass. So the interaction will change that. And in fact, sometimes interaction changes this a lot. So there are systems known as heavy Fermi liquid where this mass can be as large as 1,000 times the electron mass. It's pretty horribly interacting, but still, it's a Fermi liquid. Yes?
What does effective mass mean here? Is it just like on comparing this formulation with the superposition of?
Think about this picture. Because of this crazy cloud, the particle is moving. It has its own identity, but it's moving slower. It can be moving slower.
The particle has an effective mass.
Yes. Okay. Then, of course, you can ask a question, which is, okay, now mass can change. Can you change KF? Okay. So naively you say, okay, when I draw that picture, I said the particle will stay there for quite a while, for a long time. But then in that picture, the size of the Fermi surface didn't change. Which if you think about it, didn't have to be like that, right? Because, you know, so could the KF ever change? So there is a theorem, which I won't prove to you. That's a beautiful theorem saying that the Fermi surface volume cannot change. So if the Fermi surface is circular, that means KF cannot change. So that's known as the Luttinger theorem. The volume of Fermi C does not change under the adiabatic evolution. which means it should be the same, even in a crazy Fermi liquid state, as the free fermion Fermi surface volume. But we know that the free fermion Fermi surface volume is given by the electron density. So that means the volume of this of the Fermi C, let's say divided by some unit, let's say 2 pi over d, 2 pi to the d, equal to the density of electron. So it turns out this is true even on the lattice. So I've only shown you how a circular Fermi surface works. For example, on a lattice, you know, let's say I take a square lattice. Suppose the Fermi C originally looked like this. But then on a lattice, it's entirely possible that the shape could change. For example, under some adiabatic evolution, my Fermi surface changes a little bit like this. But the lesson is the area doesn't change. Yes.
What is
it? Spatial dimension.
This is true for general.
Yeah, 2, 3. Well, let's not talk about 1. I'll comment on 1D. In 1D will be special. But yeah, think about a Fermi liquid in 11 dimension. This will work. All right. So there are two proofs of this theorem. So if you are interested in taking a look at the proof, two equally beautiful but completely opposite in flavor. So one is in that AGD book that I listed there. The other one is done by Oshikawa. Just search the name. I think the title is something like topological approach to Luttinger's theorem. And the title has some other thing which you don't have to worry about. Just search that. Right. So this AGD proof is gymnastics in doing integration, Feynman diagrams, analytic functions. Well, this is more like a topological approach. So you look at the two proofs, they look completely different, but they all reach this same conclusion. Yes?
Someone just asked if you can say again how the mass changes under adiabatic evolution, like where this effective mass comes from.
Yes, the thing is, during this process, you expect things to change in some continuous fashion. So m, which is now defined as the energy derivative with respect to k, I mean, that's the velocity, which gives you m. So that number is, that's just a number. So there is no reason why that number cannot change, because the energy itself can change under adiabatic evolution. It's only the most intrinsic character of the state that doesn't change, right? They can all be traced back to that state. But it doesn't mean that they need to have that identical energy. That's always true for any adiabatic evolution. Okay, so let me see. So now some consequences. Okay. In fact, this line of argument comes with a huge number of consequences, but let me not get into too much detail, but just tell you a few, like two. Maybe. So the first one is, now if I measure low energy specific heat or low temperature specific heat, or if you like, I'm measuring essentially the low energy density of state. Remember, for free fermion, you get something like constant density of state, and specific heat is proportional to temperature. turns out that's still true here. Essentially, because you still have that one-to-one correspondence between low energy excitations, right? Because specific heat is counting essentially how many low energy excitations you have within some energy interval, and you do some integration, right? But remember, in the free fermion calculation, let me remind you, in your when you calculate specific heat, it's not just proportional to T, it's also proportional to the electron mass. So now, this should be replaced by that effective mass. Right. So the specific heat does change from the free fermion result, because mass is not different. But the fact that it's still linear in T doesn't change. In particular, this power 1, there's no error bar. For example, in your calculation of M star, okay, if you have some scheme of calculation, let's say do it numerically or some perturbation theory, there might be some error bar. But this T to the power 1 has no error bar. And the fact that it's proportional to M star also makes sense, because if M star is large, for example, then that means at each energy interval, I have more states, because the energy changes more slowly with momentum. Then if I have more states, I have more specific heat. So that's consequence one. The other consequence is, since these quasi-particles have well-defined charge, well, that's simply because when I do the adiabatic evolution, I start from some state with excess charge 1, for example, 1 particle. Doesn't matter how I evolved it, that final state will have total charge 1. So this particle has well-defined charge. It has well-defined momentum for the same reason, because the adiabatic turning on preserves translational symmetry. Well, it almost has well-defined energy, right? Given by that number, up to a small uncertainty. One over tau, which is, let me remind you again, it's proportional to C squared. And because it has well-defined energy, almost well-defined energy, and well-defined momentum, it has well-defined velocity, right? Defined as velocity equal to partial c, partial k, right? So this quasi-particles have well-defined, you know, essentially quantum numbers. Therefore, it makes sense to talk about the distribution function. This f, you know, essentially the distribution function in phase space, the probability distribution of particles with some momentum k, some position r, if you make it a wave packet, and time. So this is well defined, which means that Boltzmann equation is still applicable. So the Boltzmann equation turns out it will not look exactly the same as what I showed you last Friday, but it will look very similar. But the most important thing is it's written in terms of that distribution function f. So many of the main results we get from Boltzmann equation, that, you know, on transport, for example, like calculating conductivity and so on, will also be valid in this case. Yes.
Just a question. When discussing the lack of error bar in the temperature,
yes,
of a specific heat, do you,
yes,
mean it's exactly linearly dependent?
Yeah. Sorry. I mean plus things like T squared, T cubed. So those are here. What I mean is if I go to sufficiently low energy, low temperature, the leading order term is going to be linear. It's not going to be 1.1 or 0.9. Yeah, but there will always be subleading corrections. So at low enough temperature. So this is an example where simply by knowing how you should label the state and roughly how the energy should scale as that labeling, which is that, you can derive this. All right, so so these are the two out of the many consequences of the Fermi liquid theory. And let me also say that, so now you can ask the following question, actually. Is it always like this? Right. So the fact that such a theory could work, you can think of about a pretty strongly interacting system in terms of almost free particles, even though they're horribly not free if you look at that wave function, but you almost think of them as free particles. It's a miracle. This was originally designed by Landau to study liquid helium 3. So there the interaction is by no means weak, because Fermi energy is not that large, actually. But if that's all there is, it's a little bit disappointing, because that almost means interaction can't do anything drastic. And that's not true. So let me also say that adiabaticity breaks down at a phase transition. Which means if you have something drastic happening, if during the process of turning on that interaction U, you have something more drastic happened, then these assumptions won't be true. So what drastic thing could happen? For example, you may have some spontaneous symmetry breaking. So I've assumed that during the process of turning on U, I don't end up getting a magnet, for example. I don't end up getting spontaneously forming a density wave, which breaks translational symmetry. I don't end up getting a superconductor, which is what we will be covering next week. Okay. Or phase transition can mean something even more general, can be even beyond symmetry breaking, but that's a whole different subject. So okay, you can complain a little bit by saying this is almost tautology. This is saying adiabatic assumption holds when adiabatic assumption holds. But at least it's self-contained, self-consistent. Okay. Yes.
I have a question in the second consequence. I didn't quite understand what does it mean to have a well-defined charge and velocity in that picture.
In which picture?
Quasi-particle.
Yeah, you count the total charge in each component. It's one. I mean, let's define the field Fermi surface as charge zero. That's where you start counting your charge. Each component has charge one.
Okay.
You can't, for example, you can't superpose in that wave function a state with charge one and charge two. So that means that state, no matter how complicated it is, carries charge one. Same with momentum. Right. Simply because the interaction conserves charge and conserves momentum.
So yeah, one can think of quasi particles as excitations in a way.
Yeah.
So they would be like
have
to be neutral. I don't know, what does charge mean in that case?
No, you can have charged excitation, right? Throw an electron into a metal, for example. Of course, if you really want to, let's say, think about a closed system in a, for example, canonical ensemble, then you just create, every time you create a particle, you make sure you create a hole. That's fine. But the point is the particle and hole can move separately. So you can still locally talk about their charge. Right? For example, if you make a wave packet, you can measure the charge by integrating gradient the charge density over an area that's larger than the spread of that wave packet. So everything is still well-defined. Yes.
So if the this specific heat diverges in the case of like phase transitions, or like if you see that as you take the as you drive the system down to lower and lower temperatures, you get a peak of some sort. It might not diverge, but like So does that mean that this
No. Remember, this is at very low temperature. So the typical specific heat diverging you're talking about happens at some finite temperature, some critical temperature.
Right.
And below that, that has no effect. So if you go to a temperature that's even lower than that, if your system still remains a Fermi liquid, this will still show up. Because, well, simply because specific heat is guaranteed to vanish as T goes to zero by third law of thermodynamics. So if it's going to be regular, then T linear is pretty much the biggest you can have. Of course, there are even more interesting states with this power being something like 2/3 or something. But those will be more complicated.
No, but, like,
but unless you have something.
The thing is that if this specific heat actually just goes to very high values, does that somehow mean that this entire renormalization procedure here is breaking down somehow?
Like, you can say that. That assumption breaks down. Well, if you have some, let's say you have some symmetry breaking phase transition at some finite temperature, right? Then near that transition, you have to be careful.
So yes. So does that mean that those other states become more and more relevant?
Yeah, you can say that. You can say that. Okay, so right. So let me also comment that this requires usually. Let me first say usually requires a relatively large interaction strength. Usually. But there are some exceptions, which we will also do next week. The exception is what gives you the BCS superconductor. Next week. And so finally, let me make some brief comments on a subject known as non-Fermi liquid. So you can say, can I have a metal, something that looks like a Fermi surface, you know, has lots of low energy degree freedom, that's not this thing. Right? It turns out it's pretty hard. Most metals we found in nature are Fermi liquid. So. And you can even ask, what does a non-Fermi liquid look like? You know, what's the characteristic of that thing? So the possible ways to have non-Fermi liquid. So the first way is that there's still some quasi-particle in the sense that I can still label my eigenstate or something that's very close to my eigenstate in terms of some occupation number, N1, N2. So for the Fermi liquid case, that's just saying I have some momentum particle state in K1 and K2 and so on. Right, for example, this state would mean that the n at this momentum is 1 and everywhere else it's 0. Right. So it could be that the system is still described by the eigenstate can still be described by the occupation number of some particle, of some object, just not the original electron. Right? So, but not adiabatically connected to a free state. So this is true in 1D. So the examples is 1D. So if I have 1D wire of metal, right? So before I turn on interaction, it's just a free Fermion problem, which you've seen multiple times in this course. That's a simple problem. Now you turn on a little bit of interaction. Turns out that picture breaks down. That picture is not valid. Basically, it's because Z is 0. And that kind of state is known as, Z is 0. That kind of state is known as Luttinger liquid. But miraculously, it's still a solvable problem, and people have solved it. It can be understood in terms of quasi-particles, just not the original electrons. Yes?
Why do we call these things liquid?
Oh, yes. So Fermi gas means if you remember, Fermi gas means the non-interacting fermions, right? So gas plus some bit of interaction means liquid. Of course, another thing is, it doesn't form a solid in the sense that it doesn't break translational symmetry. For example, you can say if I have I should mention this. If I have just a starting from free space, let's say. Right. So you have the full translation symmetry, continuous translation and rotation symmetry. I start from some fermions. At zero interaction, it's just the ideal Fermi gas. Now I turn on some interaction, some repulsive interaction, for example. So at some reasonable value of interaction, it gets you this Fermi liquid picture. But if the interaction strength is much larger than the Fermi energy, turns out this picture breaks down. What you get is a spontaneous formation of crystals by the electron. In fact, so if U is much larger than EF, what you get is like a crystal pattern. For example, in two dimensions, it's going to be a triangle lattice. Like, essentially, the electrons spontaneously break translation symmetry and form another solid for you. This state is known as a Wigner crystal.
Sorry, we did not have any translation symmetry to begin with, right? Because if it was like...
Yeah, let me be simplistic. Let's talk about free space first. Right? On a crystal, you can have similar stuff like this. You break the crystalline symmetry further. But in free space, this is known as Wigner crystal, which is not that hard to understand. Because if the repulsive interaction is much larger than the Fermi energy, then that means the repulsion... the repulsive interaction dominates over kinetic energy. So you should, at ground state, you should first try to minimize the repulsive interaction. So this kind of crystalline pattern will essentially kind of maximize the average distance between these two between any two particles, and then that makes the repulsive interaction term happy. And then you introduce a little bit of kinetic energy. Then this particle wiggle a little bit around each side, but the entire pattern will not be broken. Yes?
Someone asked, do solid metals act as Fermi liquids?
Yes. So electrons in the metal act as Fermi liquid. Unless you crank up the interaction too much, that form this kind of thing. But in the usual metal, it doesn't. That doesn't happen. Yes?
Is this the same idea as a Mach insulator?
Not exactly. Not exactly. Yeah, so this is actually an example where this is true, right? If I have a strong enough interaction that the symmetry start to spontaneously break.
The clip's still on your shirt.
It's still here.
Oh, the clip is on my shirt. Whatever. Yeah, so then that all this assumption break down and I have to restart essentially. All right, so let me just say that, back to this example. Again, I won't tell you exactly how to solve this thing. If you take a string theory class, you may secretly learn how to solve that. Maybe you won't be told that. But so that's one example. There is another class of examples. The most famous one is known as the fractional quantum Hall effect. So there, it also turns out you can describe things perfectly well by quasi-particles, but they just don't overlap with your free fermion state. But again, let me not say too much. Then there's the other class of non-fermion liquid states that such that quasi-particle even doesn't exist to begin with. So you can't. There's no way, no matter how low energy you go to, there's no way for you to label your eigenstate, your energy eigenstate, even approximately as using some occupation numbers, right? So this will be true, for example, if somehow that 1 over tau, okay, let me just show you that. So one example is, for example, a two-dimensional Fermi surface coupled to some U1 coupled to some gauge field. There, what you will see is that this 1 over tau, which previously was proportional to C square, now is like C to some funny power less than 1. Now you have a problem. That adiabatic regime doesn't exist, right? Because the uncertainty in energy is even larger than energy itself. So this is larger than C. So there are cases where this fails, and then.
What's special if you actually couple fermions to this two-gauge field?
If you like, it's a long-range interaction. So the scattering caused by the gauge field is much more severe than the picture I draw you with a simple kind of four fermion interaction. Yes.
So is this inability to talk about quasi particles because of the long range interaction, or is it because of the field?
No, because of this number being smaller than 1. So that you actually have to calculate. Sometimes you can have long-range interaction, but still that number is larger than 1. As long as this number is larger than 1, it doesn't have to be 2. It can be 1.2, let's say. That condition can still be satisfied.
So we can still do all of this?
You can still do all of this, even if it's 1.2. Right? There are weird examples like that. But the minute it became 0.8, you're screwed. Right? It becomes non-fermion liquid. For example, in this kind of system, it's believed theoretically that if you measure the low energy specific heat, it goes like T to the power 2/3, something like that. Also, another example which is recently very popular is known as the Sachdev Ye-Kitaev model. That also belongs to this class. So if you're interested in this kind of thing, just read. I mean, you just search SYK, you probably get a million papers. So yeah. So that's it for today. But let me end by saying that when I say the quasi-particle scattering is weak in the sense that the lifetime is pretty long. I secretly lied to you a little bit. There is another channel, there is another form of interaction which is generically present in typical metals that doesn't obey that rule. And in fact, that interaction will eventually lead us to superconductivity. So let's do that next week. And that's it for today.
What interaction is that?
The Cooper channel.
Electron,
no, Cooper channel. It's like scatter two particle like doing this. You have two particle excitation and you do this.
Cool. Yeah. Can I ask a weird question?
Yeah.